Now turn to 24-2045, United States v. Guevara-Lopez.
Good morning. My name is Violet Edelman, and I represent Mr. Guevara-Lopez. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if possible. This court's recent decision in United States v. Crosby compels reversal in this case. This court is guided by the uncontroversial rule that at sentencing, a major variance must be supported by a significant justification. The district court here varied upward to the statutory maximum without justification. Most importantly here, the free-ranging extreme upward variance to the maximum was imposed without meaningful consideration of the guidelines and without consideration of the unwarranted disparity it created, resulting in a facially unwarranted sentence. The court's exclusive focus in discussing the extreme variance imposed in this case was really the number of times that Mr. Guevara-Lopez engaged in the smuggling conduct. But in doing so, the district court ignored completely the fundamental theories underpinning the pertinent guidelines, which account for the full extent of his conduct in a variety of ways. His offense level was increased by 16 based on the loss table in the guidelines. And it's clear from the relevant conduct provisions, as well as the grouping provisions in the guidelines, that the conduct is looked at in terms of the amount of loss for a reason. And that's because the number of times that a person engages in the conduct doesn't have a meaningful impact on sentencing in the way that the commission has evaluated it. So it's a conscious decision to base the increase on the amount rather than the estimated.
I think if he repeats it for over many months period of time, that suggests some additional culpability. You don't think it's an important factor or a relevant factor in sentencing?
Well, it's considered in the guidelines. So the measurement of the loss the commission has determined captures the culpability there. And even if he had been charged with multiple counts or convicted of multiple counts of the same crime, his guidelines would be the same because the commission has determined that they group together.
There's not a dispute about the guideline calculation. It's the variance that's at issue.
Right.
So it might make a difference if you were confident that the guidelines covered the component of the crime in this case that is unusual, but I'm not sure you can say that. Is there any reason to think that?
Well, the first thing is that the district court didn't explain that it disagreed with the guidelines, if it did. She alluded to it being something that was calculated by the amount of loss rather than the number of times. But she didn't say, I don't think that captures his culpability, and this is why. And this is why 60 months, the statutory maximum, which is for the worst of the worst offenders, was appropriate. So she didn't explain that it didn't reflect his culpability, and that alone renders the sentence substantively unreasonable. But, the same cell, the same guideline range would capture people who engaged in the conduct more times with maybe less money.
Or one time with all of that money.
Right.
Which would seem almost worse because you'd have to be pretty trusted to be caught with $2+ million.
That's true. And I think that the various provisions set forth in the guidelines are calibrated to put people in cells that reflect their culpability. And so when there's such an extreme variance above that range, the district court has to explain what it is about this conduct that makes it more egregious, and simply the number of times which the commission has explained doesn't necessarily aggravate someone's culpability in terms of sentencing and in its relation to the 3553A factors. It isn't enough.
But that may be the commission's position. But Judge Strickland here seemed to focus a lot on the number of times and the amount, both. And even if she didn't draw a direct line towards a specific 3553A factor for the number of times, why couldn't she conclude that the defendant sort of zipping across the border repeatedly would need to have an enhanced sentence because for deterrence purposes, in the sense that every time someone makes a conscious decision to engage in criminal misconduct, you know, that alone, that the fact that it has to happen repeatedly is an aggravator. Why isn't that? And you know, she doesn't specifically say that, but I think you can read the transcript and infer that that's the point she's trying to make, is the number of times was significant to her.
Well, the burden in imposing an upward variance like this one is on the district court to explain its reasoning. And that is a principle dating back to Gall. And it's clear in every one of this court's cases reversing on substantive unreasonableness that when there's a variance, the district court does have to actually spell it out and explain and go through an analysis of why this person deserves a sentence that's different than the one in the guidelines, and specifically one that's so far above the range. So I think that, you know, if you look at Crosby and at Cookson and at all of the cases that those two cases really crystallize, the district court had to voice its policy disagreement with the guidelines, which it didn't do. And that's something that the court did do in Crosby. But that still wasn't enough to support a variance on top of that. And also, the district court has to consider whether there are other defendants who have been similarly sentenced, similarly situated defendants who get a sentence that is comparable. And that isn't in this record either. So all you have is data showing that people who, by the way the guidelines measure it, are similar to Mr. Guevara-Lopez, having an average sentence significantly lower than his. I think it's 15 months, and 0% of offenders getting an upward variance at all. So she just didn't offer.
Well, what about this offering? She says that she's very concerned about the nature and circumstances. So now she's quoting from 3553A. And then she goes on to then say about the $2 million of cash back to organized crime in Mexico. It's a very large amount of money, and he knows, as he said today, what organized crime in Mexico is doing with the money. And as I read that, I think, you know, why couldn't we consider, you know, this is a drug transaction. As she just said, it's organized crime in Mexico. And, you know, in the transaction, drugs come one way, a sale is made, cash goes the other way. Had he been on the front end of that, carrying the drugs, not the cash, his sentencing liability would have been exponentially higher. And again, I know she doesn't say all of this, but why can't we? I mean, she's talking about the nature and circumstances, and she's talking about organized crime in Mexico. Isn't that sort of obvious inferences we can draw?
Well, there are a couple things about that. The first is that in the PSR, I don't think the PSR says anything about organized crime or about a cartel, which is the word she used at sentencing. And he did engage with her on that point. But he also received the downward adjustment for minor role. And in order to receive that adjustment, the requirement is that the person has limited knowledge of the scope of the activity. So, and she accepted that, as a factual finding. So in some sense, her then saying that he is more culpable because he admitted to some awareness when she was grilling him at sentencing, it contradicts the finding that she made in accepting the PSR and undermines really the spirit of the minor role that he played. He's also, at the time, he was only 19 years old, and his age, the commission has also acknowledged that a youthful age can impact sort of the way that somebody might understand their conduct. So I think that contributed to what he said. This is his first time in federal court having this conversation with a federal judge. So there are a lot of factors that I think reduce that as significant in her consideration. But she also didn't explain, again, how the guidelines and the loss table specifically reference the charge that he's faced with. So we assume that they do reflect this kind of conduct that he was charged with. And so her judgment that they aren't adequate for this crime, she has to explain that. In some sense, she's just treating the guidelines as if they aren't even advisory. because it's not clear where she gets the number that she ultimately arrives at in giving him the maximum. He's also somebody with zero criminal history points, and she sentenced him to the guideline maximum, which is clearly for the worst of the worst of offenders, but also that falls within the cell on the guidelines table for people in criminal history category 6, which is could be people with any number of criminal history points. So the point is that she wasn't looking at the guidelines as a reference point. There's nothing in the record to suggest that she did. She didn't seem to understand or at least didn't articulate an understanding that the guidelines might reflect the things that she was concerned about, but also didn't explain why they didn't or why an upward variance was necessary.
Let me ask you, your only issue on appeal was substantive reasonableness, is that right?
Yes.
A lot of what you're talking about is failure to explain. That's procedural reasonableness, is it not?
Well,
when we're looking at substantive reasonableness, it's nice if the sentencing judge explains the sentence. We might find something substantively reasonable because of the explanation that we wouldn't have otherwise. But the failure to explain itself is not substantive reasonableness, is it?
It can be. The two are overlapping. And this court's cases acknowledge that there's a murky area there, but also that an insufficient and inadequate explanation impedes review.
Yes.
And so that can render a sentence substantively unreasonable, because when you're looking at a term that's
It impedes review because we can't see why that sentence is justified. We find that there's failure to explain, so we reverse on procedural reasonableness grounds. Is not that what we do?
Well, in Crosby and in Cookson, and I think in Barnes,
I don't think we've ever found the sentence too long on substantive reasonableness grounds, have we?
Well, you're right. I don't think you've ever found a sentence to be too long on substantive reasonableness, but that's slightly problematic because the standard is actually, you know, the district court is entitled to greater solicitude for a downward variance than an upward variance. And so in these cases where this court has gone through a painstaking review of 3553A and looked at the explanation to see whether it's adequate, for a downward variance, certainly that standard has to apply in the case of an upward variance too. So I think the lack of that case certainly doesn't mean this court can't reverse an upward variance on the same theory. And in fact, I think in a case like this one, it's necessary.
What about the Texas charges and conduct? That's something the district court relied on.
Yes, the district court did mention that conduct, which is something that it was in her discretion to do. But again, that conduct, she never explained how that conduct sets him into either theoretical criminal history category 6 or at the statutory maximum. He also hasn't been convicted of those charges yet.
Did the district court get that wrong, or do I have it wrong, the timing as far as when the Texas conduct had occurred versus this arrest?
Yes. I believe she did get that wrong because it happened after this arrest. Or is alleged to have happened. But
does that matter? Is that a reason to send it back or not?
I don't think that's a reason for reversal now, because it is something that she could consider. But the amount of weight or the important point is that it can't justify the extent of the variance imposed, especially without further explanation.
Can I ask you on Garcia, where you have gun offenses and look at the Sentencing Commission data and it says for felon possession or something, the average sentence is X, and then defendants try to compare and say, I got worse than that, substantive unreasonable. This one is more precise, which is to say 2S1.3, the guideline, total offense level 17, which I think means acceptance of responsibility to get an odd number, and criminal history 1. So you have a very narrow group of people who presumably have a whole lot more in common than gun offenders. And I haven't seen a case that has dealt with that on substantive reasonableness, where it's zeroed in so tightly on whether doubling a sentence from the top end would be substantively unreasonable in view of that.
I see I'm out of time. May I?
Yes.
I just want to clarify. The small pool, or are you asking how the relatively small pool impacts the question of substantive unreasonableness?
I'm saying he's in that small pool. There are, between 2018 and 2022, there are 70 defendants sentenced under that guideline who have a total offense level 17, criminal history 1. The average sentence is 13 months, and he got 60. Now, I understand Garcia is not a lot of help because there's such a wide range of offenders under the umbrella of gun offenders. But this is a tiny, tiny umbrella, which is to say the 70 defendants that we're talking about have a lot in common to land on criminal history 1 and total offense level 17. So I'm wondering if there's any authority that says, well, when you narrow that sentencing commission data down to that point, then you really better have a good explanation for doubling the sentence.
Right. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head of any authority that expressly says that, but I think it does underscore the point, which is that to get into that cell, that's because of the loss table, essentially, that he got there because that's what put him in such a high offense level.
And all of the other defendants are going to be similar.
Right. Right, exactly. And so to go so far outside of that, then without looking at the comparative data or without pointing to a case where, because, I mean, like this case, this court's case, Lente, talks about where a sentence might be substantively reasonable based on policy disagreements with the guidelines or underrepresented criminal history. And the reason it was reasonable is because the court could point to evidence of other people that were similar, that had similar records, where a variance was warranted. And that doesn't seem to exist here. If it did, I think we'd be having a different conversation. But
so no cases that you're aware of?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you. Mr. King.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Emil Keeney. I'm here for the United States. And I don't know where you want to start first, but I'll just start going through defense counsel's points unless you want to go somewhere else. I think for the first argument was that the district court's upward variance was really reliant on the number of times that Mr. Guevara-Lopez committed this offense. And while that certainly was an important factor, and one of the driving factors, the district court sentence is really based on three different things. It's the number of times, the amount of money, and the culpability of the offense as expressed by his remarks at sentencing.
Was the government's recommendation? Sorry to interrupt.
Government's recommendation was for a guideline sentence.
Low end or just within?
I think we just said within, Your Honor. That's all. I know we filed a memorandum. I think we just said within. And at the sentencing, we did say just within the range. So, and the culpability that I'm talking about is the defendant's admissions during the sentencing hearing that, yes, he knew full well that the cartels use this money to fuel violence in Mexico and that this hurts people. But he didn't really consider that when he was doing he didn't think much about it because he wanted the money at the time.
Counsel, one thing that strikes me as odd as I was reading the sentencing transcript is how much of the information was distracted by the judge's questioning. The government here, sentencing memo is pretty bland, as you just says, within the guideline range. It doesn't really go beyond anything that's stated in the pre-sentence report. It doesn't argue any of the harm, you know, with cartels and violence. There's no evidence of any of that. It may allude to it, but it doesn't really press that point. But yet the court here really pressed the defendant. she vigorously questioned the defendant on all these points in a very leading manner. Is that customary in the District of New Mexico, or would you say this sentencing transcript kind of reads to you to be somewhat of an outlier?
Well, I would say that I don't think most judges do question defendants in this way. I mean, some of them will ask follow-up questions on during an allocution. I think this district judge does tend to question more defendants more than others. From the cases, I've seen a number of her cases, and I think she does that. But there's no claim here that she acted improperly by doing that. I think the main facts that were of concern to defense counsel below and that might have some force, I'm sorry, Judge Hartz, were you going to ask me something? Okay. Is that this was the defendant's first conviction, criminal conviction of any kind, and his youth. And the district court, though, did consider those factors. She explicitly says, I acknowledge this is his first criminal conviction. I acknowledge he's very young. But I still think these other factors weigh more heavily in my analysis. And just because he's not a typical, she didn't say this specifically, but on these facts, he's not a typical first-time criminal offender. He's someone who's admitted, I did this 25 or 30 times without getting caught.
He volunteered that as
right.
part of cooperation originally, I gather. They took him into the shop and...
He did.
And so he's regretting having mm-hmm. opened his mouth because it doubled his sentence at least.
I suspect he might. I mean, he's not arguing, though, that he was forced to make those statements or that there was any misconduct on law enforcement's parts in receiving his admissions. He's not raising any, he didn't file any suppression motion.
No, but is it fair to say or accurate that the only evidence that supported the relevant conduct for the loss amount was the statements that he made to law enforcement post-arrest?
I think that's fair to say. He admitted he usually took more than he was caught with this time. He was caught with something like 60 or 61,000, and he said, usually I carry between 100 and 118,000. But that was the only evidence. And at that time, he didn't admit, I know what the cartels do with the money. He said, I admit that I know this is from drug proceeds. But then at the sentencing hearing is where he admits, yeah, I knew all along what they did with this money, and it didn't stop me. So I think so while it's unusual for a first-time offender to be obtained for a district court to impose an upward variance like this on a first-time offender, I don't think it satisfies the standard. Her decision to do so satisfies the standard of substantively unreasonable sentence, which is the district court's sentence irrational or whimsical in some way.
What about if she relied on something that was inaccurate? And I think the government in sentencing memo explained to the district court that it was worth noting that the defendant committed this offense, the smuggling of cash, when he had two pending cases in El Paso County. And then I think the district court, and let me make sure I'm right about this, she says, you did it. I mean, you have pending state cases, right? So you've already been in trouble and you still did this. In other words, she may be able to consider he had pending cases in the state, but her justification for why they had any relevance to her sentence was wrong. It was false. He had not committed this, the offense for which he's being sentenced subsequent to the other state pending cases. So how do we factor that in?
Well, on the first thing you said, Your Honor, I don't have the government's sentencing memorandum in front of me. I don't remember the government saying that he had been arrested.
I'll help you. On page 4, it is also worth noting that the time the defendant committed the incident offense, he had two pending 2023 cases in El Paso, Texas District Court for drug trafficking and alien smuggling. And then it references the PSR.
And that's in our sentencing memorandum?
Yeah, page 4.
Okay. No, that's incorrect.
Okay.
And the district court was wrong to say that. We were wrong to say that.
So how do we sort of factor that into the soup here?
Well, I've thought about that, and the thing is that this is a ground on which defendant could oppose a sentence, could say the sentence is substantively unreasonable, but she didn't raise it, or that he didn't raise it in his opening brief. We're the ones who pointed out the mistake in our answer brief. could have said in his reply brief, look, this is a plain error, because this court does. I mean, sometimes this court will say, on a reply brief, we're not going to consider plain error, but the court has discretion to do that. And then even today, defense counsel said, I'm not relying on that as a ground for reversal. I think, based on the party presentation principle, at least, that defendant has abandoned that as a claim. I think the claim would be stronger with that claim, but they have.
Are you conceding that it would be worse for him to have committed this offense after being arrested or committing other offenses in El Paso than it would be for him to commit the offenses in El Paso after he'd been arrested for these offenses?
I'm not sure that it's worse necessarily. I don't know. I think you can make a case that they're both pretty bad. But if the claim was going, what I'm referring to is if the defendant had claimed, look, the district court's decision is wrong because the district court got this fact wrong, that would be a stronger claim. But the defendant is abandoning that claim. I mean, I understand that they may have very good reasons for doing that, of which I'm unaware.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about that, except that it's not before the court.
And I was going to say, I suspect that the arrest that gave rise to his statements and the relevant conduct was in 2021.
That's right.
But then it's in May of 2023 that he gets arrested by the state on the state counts, but then he's not indicted federally until June of 2023.
In March and May, I think there are two different Texas arrests, and then the next month,
Can I assume indicted. That's because that's sort of when he comes onto the radar of the federal authorities once he's been arrested?
That's what I assume, too, but I don't see anything in the record that explains why we didn't charge him until 2 years after. I mean, he wasn't even arrested. Well, he was taken to, I'm thinking he's taken to HSI when he was first found with the cash, the office in Las Cruces, and it seems like he was let go at that time.
But he was arrested? When you say taken to the office?
Yeah, I think that would count as an arrest. I think the PSR says detained, but I mean, they take him there against his will, so I think that would be an arrest.
And he's very talkative, and then he's not confined, which sounds like cooperation, which fell apart at some point, and therefore 2 years. It's all speculation.
I don't know,
Your
Honor.
You're the person who knows. I don't know.
I actually don't know. I just reviewed the record. I didn't go look at the whole file of everything, just the appellate record. Another point that my colleague made was that something about the district court's remarks contradicts the minor role finding. And I just wanted to point out that's not a claim that has been raised in the briefing. So I don't think that's before the court. I'm not sure I've thought through what I would say about that, but I don't really think there's anything that district court said that would contradict that. We've talked about the Texas charges. Judge Phillips, you mentioned there, I think at the very end, you were asking whether there's a case law about whether the number of defendants who are in a certain cell of
big pool
have the same criminal history category and offense level.
And guideline.
Right. If they have the same guideline range and the same primary guideline, if the number of defendants within that category affects the analysis in some way.
What I'm asking is, because you have this tight guideline, 2S1.3, and then it refers back to, I think, 2B1.1 for the total amount of the dollars and so forth. There just aren't that many pieces that add up to the total offense level. It ends up an odd number, so I think it's 3 for acceptance.
He got acceptance, yeah.
And these 70 people over the course of those 4 years are going to be very tight as far as it's hard to have an outlier if they're all criminal history one, where one is a rampant criminal. Or it's hard to have an outlier where somebody only had $20,000 or instead was $20 million. And they're all pretty similar. And therefore, doesn't that count as far as what's substantive reasonable when you start going from 24 low end to 60 max?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just all gun offenders.
If I came in and I said, tens of thousands and
so forth. If I came in and I said, I got 8 years for felon in possession. I'm outraged because the average sentence is five years, but I'm a criminal history six, and I threatened someone with a fire. All of those things, you can't really compare. But this one, it seems like, I don't know how you can compare it any better than to have that tied to a guideline and circumstance.
The amount of money. Except that guideline, it doesn't count the number of times. It doesn't, doesn't talk about that.
That one I'm confused by, because as I said, to have 25 or 30 trips of a lesser amount seems more innocuous than having one trip with $2.75 million, because they're not just going to hand over $2.75 million to someone. It's going to be obviously you have been involved in a lot of criminal activity if you're that trusted. So that's my point.
I think that could support an upper variance as well, but I think there's still a lot of culpability with doing it a lot of times, because if you're carrying smaller amounts of cash, I think perhaps the thinking is that you're less likely to be discovered. So, I think you can make an argument that there may be different strategies that the cartel has in doing this, and they may reflect but I think just because it's a different strategy than the one giving one guy $2 or $3 million, I don't think that the district court measurement of culpability necessarily has to be any less, because
The sentencing commission data doesn't specify how many trips, because that's not an offense characteristic. But my guess is there aren't too many who are out there a cop with $2.75 million. In other words, what this defendant confessed to doing is probably pretty standard, I would guess.
It might be, and there may be cases. I think in a lot of cases it's probably difficult for us to prove that. But here, the district court had that information before, that this defendant didn't just commit a crime one time or two times, but made a decision over a six-month period to commit this crime 25 to 30 times, and that this was something that was very concerning to her, and I think that's very reasonable to be concerned about that. Unless the court has any other questions, we would ask you to affirm.
Thank you. You have 31 seconds left, is that right?
Do you have any questions to ask her? No. Do you want to hear from her? I'll give her 30 seconds.
Yeah, for sure. See what you can do in 30 seconds.
Just on the Texas convictions, what I'd like to say is that no matter how they counted or when they occurred, those two convictions wouldn't place my client in a guideline cell that would be close to 60 months, even if they both somehow got 3 points. So that's why no matter how she treated them, it still doesn't warrant the sentence from a substantive point of view. The other thing I just want to mention about the loss and the number of times is that the guidelines say in the grouping, in the commentary, that they are not especially meaningful for purposes of sentencing, the number of times. He was sentenced as if he smuggled the very most highest amount in the loss table. Thank you.
I have one question, just to remind me. He was sentenced to 5 years?
60 months, yes. Yeah.
And what's the high end of the guideline range?
For him, I think it was 30.
24 to 30.
It was 30 months, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case submitted. Counsel excused.